After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Mind Rolling on the MindPod Network. I'm Raghu Marcus, and today we have George Balaram Pitagorsky. You just heard him shuffling some of his papers around here. And welcome, George.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Yeah. So I'm going to hang out with George. I call him Balaram because that's his spiritual name, and actually that's how I knew you way back in the day as Balaram,
right?
But his professional name is George Pitagorsky, and as George, he writes these. What are they? Every month.
Every month.
Yeah. And I'm on. Pretty regular.
It's a breakthrough newsletter.
Right. And Balaram's been on the podcast before with David and I. And in this case, there's a couple of... I get the newsletter. By the way, if you want to get the newsletter... Well, we're going to tell you where to go to get find him and everything. But I get them, and there was a couple of them that I wanted to just hang out with Balaram and talk about, which we are going to do, and they're pretty timely, especially given, because this today, although the podcast is going to come out later than the day we're doing it, today is Martin Luther King Day, which is an important day, and very, very much in line with some of the thoughts that Balaram's had here. I just want to remind everybody that we are on a continual basis. We're like PBS, NPR. We are supported by our community. And so just going to briefly ask you to remember, I don't have any picks for Amazon, but please do this week. Just maybe a little bit lazy. I should have talked to you about this. I bet you've got some great things in mind. Books that you've read, Balaram, that we recommend. Do you have a book that's on your mind?
Well, I have books that I've written, but recently I've been writing a book, and therefore it's curtailed my reading. Mm. Actually, the most recent thing that I've read is... a reread of Sokhne Rinpoche's Fearless Simplicity.
Which I don't is know quite that nice. Book. Oh.
Yeah, it's his, I think it's his second book. And it's very nice. It's a wonderful explanation of Dzogchen teachings from his point of view.
Okay, so first of all, Sokhne, let's say, spell Sokhne Rinpoche.
T-S-O-K-N-Y-I, Sokhne. Rinpoche, R-I-N-P-O-C-H-E.
And the title?
And the title is Fearless Simplicity.
I love that. Okay, I'm going to get it, and I'm sure you can get it on Amazon.
Yeah, yeah.
Wait, we're forgetting something. We're talking about Dzogchen, and we need to give a little bit of a definition.
Oh, what is Dzogchen?
Yeah.
Well, Dzogchen is... a non-dual teaching. It's the non-dual teaching that comes out of the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, also from the Bon tradition in Tibet. And basically, the underlying premise is that there's a basic ground that we are all in, and unfortunately don't recognize every moment of every day. But that basic ground is this quality of boundless emptiness suffused with clarity. And the book is about that and how to cultivate a growing realization of that ground.
Okay, there's a mouthful on Dzogchen.
Understandable mouthful, I hope.
Yeah, we hope. But, we hope. Yeah.
But that's what it is. So.
Yeah, but the title of the book speaks to me. So
I mean, basically, the notion is that in order to experience this this stateless state, one needs to be rather fearless, and because it requires giving up lots of self-identification and more and more just resting in the moment of presence.
Well, of course, this is a huge subject matter, and Dzogchen, and one of the podcasters on MindPod Network is Lama Suryadas, who is very good at elucidating the Dzogchen teachings and getting them so that they can be of a little bit of more practical for us on a day-to-day basis. And practical is what we're going to be talking about in terms of what's going on in this country these days. So just to get back to our little commercial here about taking the getting this book that we Tsokni Rinpoche's book on Amazon and bookmarking. We always encourage you to bookmark so that MindPod Network, Mind Rolling gets a little piece of it, and in that way sustains what we're doing. Your donations are extraordinarily helpful, and the recurring ones by every month, even a small amount, that goes a long way if we can get enough people to do that. And we have our store. Yeah, Balaram, we have a store now with a mindfulness kit. You should look up there on MindPod Network, yeah. And it's chock full of items to remind you on a day-to-day basis of the empty nature of our being. And by the way, when we talk about emptiness, and I have to keep reiterating this, everybody, this is empty of, and the plainest way to say it is empty of that constant self-referential mind from the moment that you wake up about me. It's me. I got to go to the bathroom. I got to get my coffee. Then I'm going to go, oops, I got to go. Oh, what am I going to do today? So it's a constant, is it not? And so really emptiness is once you become empty of this self-referential and self-interested and self-cherishing life that we lead day to day. Even the incremental realization of that is such a huge improvement. So yeah. That's something to aspire to.
I like to also think of emptiness in terms of fullness, because basically when we can really get in touch with that that quality that's not constantly referring to self and I and me, we are now open to just the reality that everything is completely available within this this emptiness, within this ground of clarity and emptiness, so that it becomes very full. It's not like nothing.
Yeah, right. It's not nihilistic, which is most how most people interpret emptiness of the Buddhist that Buddhist concept. And you know, what's left is of course love, which is more of what we are how we are interconnected. Okay, we're going to move on. That was a hell of a sponsor pitch or whatever. Support pitch. So you've got a couple of articles here that I want to talk about. And this first one is, of course, it's freezing cold today. And you talk about the winter solstice brings with it a diminishing of darkness and the return of light. Right? And we're right in the thick of that. It's a season for reflecting on miracles, love, and renewal. Yet, we are facing a wave of fear-based bigotry that will not go away if we close our eyes and imagine everybody's hearts and minds will be filled with goodwill for all. And it's just going on a day-to-day basis with these as soon as I even think of this, I immediately say, as we are in the convention season, and then we watch these debates, or we watch whatever, the news, it's on our feed, our Facebook feed, our Twitter feeds, the Republicans, and headed by Trump and Cruz, and all of them. And as soon as that happens, it's polarization. Okay, that's the first thing that happens. These ignorant MFs, okay? So that happens immediately. Now, what you're talking about here is interesting, right? It's about, and you're talking about, because it is true, and now, of course, truth is in the, like, beauty is the beholder there. But when these hate mongers spread their message and embellish it with information, it's a very, very, very difficult situation to sit, as you say, sit quietly around this. And especially, you know, the talking about the need to keep Muslim Syrian refugees out of the country, to protect us from terrorism, it's just fueling tremendous ignorance. And now what you're talking about is confrontation is necessary in the light of this spreading of these messages. It means speaking up and inserting facts and alternative views. How, talk about this, and how we think, you think, we need to have a perspective that allows us to be effective without polarizing. Very difficult, no?
This is very difficult, and just to give you an idea of how difficult it is, I went to an event today and was speaking to an old friend, somebody I have known for like 45 years. Turns out that this old friend would prefer to vote for a Republican rather than one of the Democratic candidates. And I was like flabbergasted. And starting to talk about the choice that this person was making wrought immediately defensiveness on that person's part, on her part. And the statement was, well, we shouldn't talk about politics because it's too disruptive and it's, you know, it doesn't go anywhere. So I didn't push it, basically. But at some point, unless we really bring to the surface the controversy, and, you know, as you said, the perception that what the Republican Party seems to be selling at this point in time is ignorance and hatred and fear, that unless we say something about it, unless we really bring out the reality through a questioning and some kind of dialogue, that people will be deluded into thinking that these people are talking about is rational. So how do we do that without polarizing? It's not an answer that comes quickly to my brain. It's basically, I think we have to understand that some polarization is necessary. If you have a negative pole and a positive pole, the goal is to somehow create a unity, a unified understanding. But in order to do that, there has to be initially some kind of a confrontation. So can we do that confrontation by eliminating the MF concept that you brought up earlier, the anger and the dismissiveness of seeing that what these people are about is really negative, it's anger, it's, you know, all of these things that we choose not to deal with. And what does all of that bring up in us? Anger. Yeah, we call them MFs. You know, we call them ignorant assholes and what have you. So can we now use some quality of mindfulness to feel the sense of anger, feel the sense of frustration coming up, sit with that for a moment or two and see if compassion can be the source of whatever it is that we have to say.
Difficult.
Difficult.
And I guess we also have to look somehow. And I guess it's really more possible, like you were just with a person today who you were astounded by the fact that they thought that they would support a Republican, I guess by virtue of your past friendship and so on. And then it's a matter of how do we sit down and say, okay, how are you feeling about this? What are your feelings relative to what is being represented by these particular candidates? And trying to have some empathy, because if we don't have any empathy for as you say, the positive and the negative pole, so in this case, the negative pole, how can we can't even begin to try and meet that?
Well, I think that we have to be able to somehow put ourselves into that other person's position. What is motivating them to be at that pole? So in the case that I talk about in this article on shedding light, the issue seemed to come down to fear. You know, it was not articulated by the other person. I'm afraid of Muslims, but the anger and the desire to to do something was coming from fear. And I think a lot of the current the current rap from coming from the Republican Party in particular is fear based. We're afraid that the economy is not going to be good. We're afraid that the terrorists are going to come into our neighborhoods and schools and so forth. So the empathy comes now from understanding and feeling the quality of fear that the other person might be experiencing. Mm. Then can we use that entree as a means for getting them to reflect a little bit on their fear? Reflect, okay, we're afraid. We don't want, who wants terrorists to blow up our house or whatever? Can we now think of different options that might be appropriate to deal with the fear? Not all fear is irrational. So what are the options that we have? Will not allowing any Muslims into the country actually work? Will it do anything? How will it affect the, how many million, I don't know how many Muslims are currently in the country. It's not going to affect them in any way, shape, or form. How do we use that notion of, okay, you got a fear, it's a rational fear. What can we do in order to alleviate that fear, if it's possible to do anything? Mm-hmm. And then if we do something, will it have a negative effect? What impact will it have? You start discriminating against people because of their religion, it's probably not going to make them your friend. It's going to cause them to, to be more and more alienated, and then maybe move into a more reactive kind of mode.
Yeah, increase the polarization on all sides. I think to even I want to go back one step with all of this, and this is our main theme here has been on mind rolling, is what do you do with your own heart to be able to even sit down and say to somebody honestly on the quote-unquote the other side of whatever it is, honestly say, what is hurting you? Mm-hmm. What are you feeling that is causing you to react in this way? And this, of course, this is one of the best examples here, because we're talking about a country that was designed about allowing immigrants to come in and be part of this melting pot. And here was your opportunity. Come and, Statue of Liberty. Mm-hmm. And now we're talking about completely going opposite of that concept. So how do we actually get our hearts in a place where we can honestly, and honesty is a good word here, is the byword here, because you can just say this bullshit and don't mean a word of it. How do we honestly open ourselves to be able to hear somebody else? And geez, you've done a lot of conflict resolution stuff in your life. I know it, especially in the business world. But it seems to me that that's the first, nothing can happen unless that happens first inside each one of us.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, so it starts with the ability to, you know, to really come in touch with our own heart, our own feelings, have some kind of empathy, some kind of a connection with the other party, feel what they're feeling, and not expect them to actually work in that same way.
Right.
You know, to understand that they might not be ready to open their heart and to, you know, to come into communion with other people. They're so caught up in that I thought that that nothing outside of that is going to make any difference at all.
And I think we look to our teachers, our leaders, for help in this area. And today commemorates a man who we need look no further to.
Absolutely.
Dr. Martin Luther King. And he would be our absolute, the epitome of following and opening up a heart. And his whole conceptual evolution to a place where he you listen to his speeches, you see those the archival footage of him, and you read everything about him. He actually accomplished this.
Yeah.
He was not hateful in his heart, even when people were getting severely beaten and killed.
Exactly.
So I wish we could find a way to take, we're celebrating him today, right? But how do we find a way to reintroduce him to not just the Republicans, to all of us, to give us some sense of how to put one foot in front of the other with what's going on?
Well, I think, you know, we start by recognizing him as a as an ideal, you know, as a really a paradigm. And the wonderful fact of having actually a day set aside for that kind of remembrance of not only his birthday, but what he really stands for is a wonderful starting point. Because now we have the opportunity to, you know, turn on the television and at least for a moment get a sense of what Martin Luther King was talking about, you know, and how he actually was capable of doing exactly what we're saying, which is open your heart to people who you pretty much know in the short term is not going to, they're not going to change their mind. They're going to still be hating, you know, maybe over 30 years or 40 years, they'll start to soften in some way. But he was able to just recognize that they're where they're at, and all we can do is open our heart to them, love them for who they are, and at the same time, not just lay back and right. accept the fact that what they're going to do is, you know, walk all over us, you know. We don't want that either.
Yeah, and use what you say here, which is, you know, necessary confrontation.
Exactly.
It should be a you could coin something here, heartful confrontation.
Heartful confrontation. I love it.
Yeah. You can have it. And I love what you say. So, I mean, I wish there was somebody who put together a program that could go on, you know, on primetime network tonight that brings him into this kind of a conversation with people who have tremendous influence. You know, I mean, we're, you and I are sitting here on Mind Rolling Mind Pod Network,
right.
And we're with our friends that are listening and our community and making these, addressing these issues and making these presumptions of possibilities. And I wish it could get into the hands of people who have obviously, you know, much wider recognition and acceptability.
Yeah, we're kind of preaching to the choir, so to speak. And Wouldn't it be wonderful if one of the presidential debates actually addressed this particular issue?
Yeah. Yeah.
That would be nice.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be great. And I love what you say. I'm reminded by history that the fearful fall prey to the promise of security and simplistic certainty. They give away their freedom and common decency. In the end, everyone suffers.
Yeah. And this is, you know, we've seen this so many times in history, you know, from the dark ages all through, you know, all throughout modern history. People are just wanting somebody to help them and to save them from, you know, the unknown, from the uncertainty of you know, whatever is going to happen to them. And they're just willing to give it all up. Nazi Germany is, you know, like a perfect example of that.
Yeah.
But, you know, hopefully we're in a state, you know, kind of, and, you know, I'm generally optimistic, but my optimism is tempered by the fact that there's more and more ignorance, it seems, floating around than I've ever remembered in my life. It's, you know, it's just become endemic. So what we have to do is be even more confrontative in that heartfelt, loving way, and you know, like really bring out the sense of how important it is to be open-minded and not driven by fear.
Yeah. And what you say, I'm reminded that historically progressive thinking and right action has triumphed, though the struggle has often been long and hard. And what about Reverend King back here? I mean, how long he struggled, and beyond his lifetime, how long it took.
And
look
still,
what, but the fact still, is we have an African-American president. I mean, even though there's tremendous racism, all that stuff with our police officers in different cities targeting young black men and so on and so forth is endemic. At the same time, there has been, the struggle has been long and hard, but there has been some results. And I guess all we can do is keep a positive attitude.
Yeah, I think that the results have been very positive, but the struggle is not over. Bob Marley has a wonderful song, War.
Yeah.
Until the color of a man's skin makes as little difference as the color of his eyes, there's war.
Yeah, right.
You know.
Okay, now we're going to move on to something else, which is another article. So this first, we start with something very universal and very topical, what's going on in the world. It's going on in this country in particular. And we're going to move to something about, because we're talking about changing our hearts. If we change our hearts, we can change, we have a chance, an opportunity to change somebody else's heart. And live with a peaceful heart, Ram Dass. When you live with a peaceful heart, you'll live in a peaceful world. And that really means what we're talking about, which is only with that kind of peaceful heart do you have any chance at effecting change. Because if you're angry and you're polarized, you have no chance at all. And I fight that. This is how I started the thing out with my, just looking at the convention and the people and the news, and it, you know, it's the MFs of this world, and I get completely caught. So now you have this one, this quote, by the way, which is, I didn't know, you have it a little different than I've known about it. Don't worry, be happy. Mayor Baba, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is the first thing that woke me up when I was a teenager. And I was looking to, and how do I get out of this suffering? What is this world about? What is this life about? You know, all of those questions.
Sure.
But you have, do your best. Then don't worry, be happy. Where did you get that?
I got that, of all places, on the internet.
Is it true, though? It's on the internet.
Well, I didn't do a huge amount of fact checking, but it turns out that that quote came in a dialogue that that Mayor Baba was having with a student of his, who was basically worried about the fact that he wasn't meditating well enough, or he wasn't achieving what he wanted to do. And Mayor Baba said to him, just do your best. And then don't worry, be happy.
Love Mayor
So even
Bowie.
If he didn't say it, it's still a good thing.
Yeah. By the way, look up, folks, look up Mayor Bava, and he has a series of wonderful books. Jesus, I can't remember the name of them right now. Do you?
I don't remember the name of them.
Just go to Amazon, folks. Look up Mayor Bava. That's another thing you can do is get some Mayor Bava books. They are just incredible treatises on the spiritual path.
Yeah, yeah, he's wonderful.
And he was the first thing I saw. I saw a picture of him smiling, and you have that on in your newsletter. And don't worry, be happy. And then I'm, oh, God, I don't know. It just hit me. Okay, I'm there, you know. And so yeah. I think
I like the first part of that, the do your best
part. Yeah, do
part
your
of it,
best,
because it
yes.
brings out the notion that this is not just about, you know, lay back and, you know, get stoned and be happy. It's then don't worry. It's like you got to do something as well.
Yeah. And then you quoted this article in the Times. Worry was reported to be beneficial. Those who worried about an outcome tended to have a less stressful reaction when the worrisome outcome occurred, and a greater positive response when things worked out well. Okay, right. Well, this is a little turn as far as I'm concerned in terms of worry. I'm a worrier. I have been a worrier, and I cannot say that it has been beneficial to me. You better explain that one.
Well, I use that as a starting point. Because basically, this is, you know, some kind of psychological study that was done that found that people were less stressed when they were worried about something, but not during the worrying part. They were less stressed after the fact, and more happy about the fact that what they were worrying about didn't come to pass. But I think that if one has a sense of what negative possibilities could happen, and one doesn't dwell on it, then there's the possibility of, okay, here's something that could happen. It's, I don't want this to happen, but it could happen. Can I do anything about it? And I go on to talk about that later on in this article that says that if we use the content of our worry skillfully by analyzing the risk of it occurring and seeing what we can do to avoid it and so forth, then that cuts the the stress aspect of the worrying. But as I think we'll see when we perhaps listen to some talk about what Joseph Goldstein has to say about this, if we persist, if there's a persistency, an obsessive quality to it, worrying and worrying and worrying, then we're kind of creating stress in ourselves. The next paragraph in this article is interesting because it's the other side of the coin. It's basically Rudolf Abel, who's a character, who's actually a live character. He was a spy that was arrested in the United States, and the movie The Bridge of Spies is about him. So two times in the movie, one time he's going on trial and his lawyer, played by Tom Hanks, it says to him, you know, you could be sentenced to death. Aren't you worried? And he says, would it help?
Yeah, I love that in the movie. That is, I probably even more than maybe twice or three times he says that. But the way he says that, whoever that actor was, it was like, right, right. So great.
Yeah, it's great. So, you know, so then, you know, would it help? Yeah, maybe it would help in some cases, but not usually.
Yeah. Yeah, and you do say here, worrying can be harmful to your health and well-being. I mean, because it can be an addiction and an obsession.
Exactly.
That people use it as a fulcrum for life. And it's, my mother used to do it all the time, and she used to say, well, it's a way, if I do it, then then the bad shit won't be happening, you know. It'll be like it's like a talisman to ward off.
Right.
I go, really, are you crazy? And you gave this to me, Mom.
That same school of thought thinks that if you say something good is going to happen, it gives you a kanahara.
It'll be just great. It's a good luck. Yeah. But you do go on here about waking up. So talk about worry can wake you up to see the risk and uncertainties that are ahead, so you can have the opportunity to chart the most effective course to accomplishing your goals and objectives. So talk about that a little bit, because that is it's something different in terms of the quote-unquote spiritual teachings and spiritual path to talk about worry in that way.
Right. So when we worry, we're actually experiencing a feeling. So our feelings, our emotions, they energize us. They wake us up. That feeling is based on some set of thoughts that we have that are coming up. We see the future. We see the past. We, you know, generally based on the past, we see that something terrible might happen in the future. And all of a sudden, we now have an opportunity to either get lost in the thinking and the worrying and just obsess about it, or by waking up to the fact that something could possibly happen, we now go into an analytical process. I'm a project and program management expert in my spare time. So in that realm, there is this notion of risk management. So what is risk management? It's seeing, oh, here's something to worry about. We call it a risk. It could happen. What's the probability of it happening? If it does happen, what's the impact that it might have? Now, if the probability is really high and the impact is really high, I'm going to spend some time trying to figure out what I might be able to do to avoid that risk, or to at least reduce the impact that it might have if it occurs. Yeah? So once we do that, there's the possibility now of we're not worrying anymore. What we've done is transformed that feeling from a worrisome, anxiety-based kind of feeling to bring it up into the intellect, fuel our clarity, and now we've transmuted worry into planning and into something that is going to positively help us into the future.
Mm. That is now, go ahead.
I was just going to say that we might find that the probability of what we're worrying about is like really, really low, that in and of itself will tell us, you know, like, why would I be worrying about it? Will it help? what's the purpose?
Right, right. By the way, everybody out there, the possibility is me engaging with this very proper analysis, as Balaram is elucidating here, is zero. Okay, because I'm one of those worriers that I'm getting into it for the emotional hit. Okay, I can tell I'm getting into it that way, and analyzing it is probably out of my realm. But I want you to know that I know this man for a long time, and he executes what he's talking about, okay? Because he absolutely has an accomplishment relative to equanimity that would allow him, he's grimacing, by the way, a little bit, that would allow him to be able to do the kind of analyzation and be able to drop the worry once that analyzation has occurred, okay? So we're two different characters, he and I. And all of this is to say that although this may not be part of the possibilities for my character, personality, incarnation, there are many people like Balaram, and you all can take advantage of that analyzation. That's all I'm saying.
But now, here's an interesting possibility that those of us who do dwell in some, in the non-analytical realm, can we bring in a sufficient amount of analysis to counteract the normal habitual process of, in this case, obsessing about the worry? Mm. You know, do we have to live with the character that we're born with, or do we have the possibility of addressing it in some way, yeah, bringing remedies into play?
Right. And here's a good time, because I was sharing this with Balaram earlier. on a podcast. I've done a few of them with Joseph Goldstein, that wonderful Vipassana insight meditation teacher. And he had this little thing that I excerpt. It's going to be part, by the way, this is a little bit of a preview, Balaram, for an online retreat that's going to be part of the HeartMind app that MindPod Network is producing. And this is a preview. And so I'm going to play this for everybody, and we can comment on it afterward. This is Joseph Goldstein on worry.
So with worry, this ties very much into what we were just talking about in terms of being mindful of thoughts, because usually worry is prompted, the feeling of worry, you know, is prompted by different thoughts that we're having, you know, and mostly it's thoughts about future, but maybe it's involved with thoughts of past or even present. So first, I think it's to recognize the particular thought patterns that are arising with respect or which give rise to the feeling of worry. So actually somebody on a retreat some time ago, and this was in a book, and maybe, have you seen the book 10% Happier? Dan Harris.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I was going to mention that to you because there's an app participated in.
So he asked this question, and he tells this story in the book. He said, "Well, isn't it helpful? You know, at the end of the retreat, I'm going to be going to the airport, and what happens if I miss my plane? And isn't this something I should be worried about? You know, because the book is quite delightful, because he comes to the practice as a total skeptic, you know, and his description of the retreat is very funny as well. But he raised a good point. Aren't there things in our life that we should be worried about? And I think it's because we have the sense that there is a place for it, that we use that as a rationalization for being swamped by it. Well, I should be worried about this. Is a worrisome situation. But as I pointed out, you know, when he asked that question, I said, yes, this is something, you know, that you should be concerned about. And you plan for it. But how many times do you have to plan for it? Once, twice, three times. The 17th time you're thinking about missing the plane, it's clearly not helpful. It's not serving anything. So one of the antidotes when we're caught up in worried thoughts, and especially if they're a pattern, you know, if they're very repetitious, and we're not learning anything in terms of how we should address the situation, we're just caught in that cycle. We could ask ourselves with these kind of thoughts, is this useful? Just that simple question. Is this thought useful? And very often that's enough to unhook us from the identification with the pattern, because we see, yes, it may have been useful the first time or second time or 10th time, but it's not endlessly useful, right? And so it just takes us again, it gives us another perspective on the content, so that at that point, we can more easily drop into the awareness, oh, this is just a thought, and tune into the empty nature of thought. Right? That it really, as a phenomenon, is very insubstantial, because we see in that moment that the content is no longer serving us. So I think that kind of mindfulness of that particular pattern is very helpful in terms of freeing us from simply being lost in that conditioning. And some people live their whole lives in a state of worry.
So there you go. That is Joseph, who is so wise and so insightful. That's why he's an insight teacher. What do you think about what he's
Well, I think it's very much in keeping with my own experience with this and the idea. For one, I don't know if Joseph mentioned this specifically, but the idea that in the world of insight meditation, the Buddha talks about hindrances, things that keep us from being calm, keep us from being concentrated, and so forth. One of them is worry, restlessness, and worry. So restlessness of mind, lots of thoughts coming up, and generally many of those thoughts are worrisome, so we get caught up in the worry. So we don't necessarily look at those hindrances as being bad. We look at them as kind of wake-up calls. So if I can now recognize that, there's worry. No longer am I totally identified with that worry. I have now the possibility of distancing it from myself. It's not owning me. I'm not owning it. It's just there. It's a phenomena that's arising. And the more I see it in that way, the less impact it has. Then the worrying starts to pass away. It's usually replaced by some other kind of crazy thought or tiredness or wanting to have this or not wanting to have that and all of that stuff. But each time any of those hindrances come up, we have the possibility now of seeing them for what they are. It's just stuff coming up, just phenomena.
Yep.
Now, rest in the state of, quote, emptiness.
Yeah. Oh, clarity. Back to emptiness.
Back to emptiness and clarity.
I will say, though, in terms of practical, I mean, for me, who has been a worrier, I keep saying my mother, my poor mother, I'm blaming her for this, but it seems to me we were so close in that way. But I'll say to everybody, and I've said this before, but when people say, look, you've been doing this for decades, what the hell have you gotten out of it? Well, when that worry comes, there's room around it. There's spaciousness. I am not jumping into it the way that I used to jump into it. As Trungpa Rinpoche would talk about, a sense of humor and a sense of spaciousness around it. So I still... I'm quite aware of my incarnational shortcoming, shall we say?
Right.
But I am not jumping into it the way that I used to and where it would overtake my life. And I think that that kind of leverage really does come through mindfulness practice, through whatever the hell your practice may be, as long as you're doing it on a day-to-day basis and you have the intention that you know, as you just said, this is worry. This is not who I am. Identifying with that thought is not who I am. And in so doing, there is some leverage to allow spaciousness to happen where you're just not as caught. And you get less and less caught as time goes on. So definitively, yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. There was something else that... I just wanted to mention, it's something else that I saw. Is there anything more around this that we are...
No, I think we've
covered worry.
Yeah, I think we've covered worry.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, thanks for that. Those are two great blogs, articles. I'm quite happy to receive... By the way, tell everybody, how do you receive your monthly newsletter? I want that
to... Get my monthly newsletter, go to my website, which is pitagorskyconsulting.com. And on that website, you'll see a button to click for the newsletter, the breakthrough newsletter. If you can't remember the name of...
Oh, no, we're going to have it on the website.
Oh, okay, great.
Yeah.
So
on the page.
You can also just Google or Bing, whatever it is your proclivity is for Googling, Breakthrough Newsletter. And Pitagorsky is the publisher, author, and chief cook and bottle washer.
Bing? What is Bing? I don't even
know. Oh, Bing is the Microsoft equivalent to Google. Oh. Not quite as nice.
Yeah. One hundredth of 1% of everybody who
exactly.
Googles. Yeah. So
Google is the Jell-O of gelatin industry.
Yeah, no, exactly. Well, this is great. Very great. And I'm happy to hang with you, Balaram.
Yes.
And we should make this a regular practice as you keep coming up with these wonderful blogs. And I encourage everybody to sign up there and get them, because they are very, very helpful on a day-to-day basis. And we look to share some more with Balaram. Also is a meditation teacher. We haven't talked about that. No. Where can people, if you're in New York, guys, I mean, many people say to me, okay, well, how do I actually access somebody who can help me just with day-to-day practice? I mean, this is a monumental thing for everybody, is to just learn some of the most direct, simple methodology to do what we're saying at the very beginning of this podcast, when we talk about the polarization, what's going on in this in our country, and we say change your heart and change the world. Very simplistic, but what we really mean is practice is necessary. There's no, we're talking about this with worry. You have to use mindfulness, but the basic stuff is learning a meditation practice. And of course, we are going to supply some of this stuff for the Heart Mind app that we're producing. But talk about your programs in New York a little bit, so everybody who's in the New York area has a chance.
Sure. So at New York Insight Meditation Center, NYIMC.org, is where I do most of my teaching. And just to give you an example of the kind of programs there, I'll be starting a program January 24th with an all-day retreat that's open to everyone. And it's the first part of a course called Conscious Living, Conscious Working, a course that I developed with a good friend of mine, Michael Dana. And now I'll be teaching it with another teacher. But basically, the course and the all-day event is really about how to integrate mindfulness meditation, skillful living, and a wisdom view into your daily life, whether at work or play. Mm. And by doing it over a course of 5 months, people really get an opportunity to experience what it means to bring mindfulness into their lives. And as such, to now have an opportunity to think and act in a different way.
Right. So, perfect.
Yeah. Let me also say that I do coaching, and I can do that via Skype or phone or physically. But I do live in Manhattan. And if you're in this area, check out New York Insight. And there are many, many different opportunities for beginners courses as well as more advanced courses.
And our idea is to work with Balaram George Pitagorsky on him. He's going to record and has done so. And we will work something out where we make these courses available that he's doing through a MindPod network and the HeartMind app. So that's something to look forward to as well. Well, thank you, Balaram. This has been wonderful and very useful given this very special day of Martin Luther King and what he represents. And hopefully we can all find a way to hear him in a deeper and deeper way. Not just those of us that are not in the choir, those of us that are in the choir need to hear that in a deeper way, I believe, because nothing's going to happen until we do. So that's my last word on it. And this is Mind Rolling. And Balaram, see you next time.
See you next time. Thank you.
Go to mindpodnetwork.com and we'll see you next week.